8 a.m. haven't arrived. I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order, and good morning. Welcome, everyone. And we do have a quorum. And so we're looking at the March 28th, 2019 minutes. Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of the March 28th, 2019 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to call for the vote on those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The March 28, 2019 the minutes are approved. First bill up on the calendar, we have House File 2756. Representative Sandell. And do we have someone who cares? Representative Les Lagarde moves House File 2756 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. And members, we do have a DE2 amendment. Representative Les Lagarde moves the DE2 amendment. And Mr. Williams, if I could call on you to explain what the DE2 amendment does.
Mr. Chair and members, the DE2 amendment makes two changes to the underlying bill. The first one is largely technical in nature. It replaces the definitions of qualified dividends and long-term capital gains with a single term, which is adjusted net capital gain for determining what counts as preferential rate income. And adjusted net capital gain is the same as the sum of your qualified dividends and long-term capital gains. It's actually the term that federal law uses to determine what income qualifies for the preferential federal rate. So that's the technical change. The substantive change in the DE amendment is it limits the amount of the taxpayer's preferential rate income, which is the income subject to the tax in the bill. It limits the amount of preferential rate income to the taxpayer's federal taxable income. And the sort of case that this would make the most difference is if a taxpayer had a large long-term capital gain or a large amount of qualifying dividends, but also had large business losses, that taxpayer under the base bill would have had to pay this additional tax, but this sort of limits it to FTI, sort of allowing those business losses in that case to offset the long-term capital gains and dividends.
Very good. Any questions, members? Otherwise, I'm going to call for the vote on the DE2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Sandell, to your bill.
Well, Chair Marquardt, members of the committee, and ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm here, of course, to ask for your support for House File 2756, and this is an ambitious effort to meet the challenges and opportunities of the future. This legislation is not just an effort to help plug the holes or caulk the seams of a ship to keep it afloat. It's a bold step towards strengthening the ambitious initiatives of this session's agenda. House File 2756 would add a 3% tax to an individual's long-term capital gains and earned dividend income over $500,000. It would raise more than $200 million in 2019 tax year and somewhat less in the following 3 years, according to our estimates. It exempts income from the sale of Type 2 agricultural property and provides other considerations for individuals who are non-residents or only part-time residents of Minnesota. Our estimates vary in the number of individuals who would pay the new tax, somewhere between 1,700 and maybe 2,500 individuals. The revenues raised by this legislation would be directed to the general fund, where it would be used to support education, transportation, health care, the enhancement and protection of our natural environment, provide social services that benefit all of us and our neighbors, encourage responsible business practices, protect our less fortunate and vulnerable citizens, strengthen the economy of small towns and rural areas, and help pay for our state government's operations. I know there are those who believe that additional taxes dampen economic growth, reduce investment, or act as a disincentive to business, and I've had respectful conversations with many of them, including some of them who will testify here this morning. But research and analysis from conservative publications like The Economist, as well as economists like Arthur Stiglitz, Thomas Pinckney, or the Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman and others contradict those presumptions. This is a progressive effort, offering those who have benefited most from Minnesota's strong economy, our great workforce, our productive business environment to chip in and join those who pay an even higher tax rate on income earned from their daily contributions and effort for the services and the environment that we all enjoy. I'd be happy to talk more about this legislation or to invite others more familiar with the details and calculations to answer your questions. Thank you.
Very good. So any questions, comments for Representative Sandell at this point? And otherwise, we can go to testifiers. All right. I think we'll go to testifiers then. So we've got Mr. Phelan and then Mr. Egger and Ms. Cadoon kind of in that order.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name, please.
Good morning. My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist with the Center for the American Experiment. We're a think tank based in Golden Valley, and I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. Minnesotans are some of the most heavily taxed citizens in America. In our report, The State of Minnesota's Economy 2018, we at the center noted that Minnesota's top rate of income tax, 9.85%, is the fourth highest in the country. This is the rate at which capital gains are currently taxed in the state. Most states tax capital gains in exactly the same way. This bill would effectively give Minnesota the highest marginal rate of capital gains taxation in the United States. Raising this rate could harm economic growth in the state. High capital gains taxes do create what is called a lock-in effect, where investors avoid onerous taxation by not selling assets. Empirical evidence shows a strong link between higher capital gains tax rates and this lock-in effect. If high taxes make investors unwilling to sell taxable assets, the lock-in effect can reduce economic growth by preventing the reallocation of capital in low-performing investments to more profitable ventures. Economic growth slows as new businesses find it difficult to acquire startup or expansion capital. This may already be a problem in Minnesota with our current tax rates. In our 2018 report, we found that Minnesota lagged the national average on capital per worker by 3.9%, that we lagged the national average on new and young businesses as a share of all businesses by 30% to 34%, a gap that has widened over time. We found that in 2017, the average American worker had $375 of venture capital behind him or her. In Minnesota, the figure was just $137, 63.5% less. Over the period 2002 to 2017, Minnesota's stock of venture capital increased by 39% in real terms, compared with a 249% increase for the nation as a whole. Minnesota is a below-average labor productivity state. Our state lags national averages on output per worker, output per hour worked, and per worker GDP and personal income. We are only able to achieve above average levels of GDP or personal income per capita because of our above average labor force participation rate. As Minnesota's population ages and its population and its participation rate falls, Minnesota will need more investment to make the dwindling share of the state's population in employment more productive, not less. But that is exactly what this bill will encourage. For the sake of the state's economic future, I would urge the committee to drop this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Mr. Egger. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors. We are a trade association with over 20,000 real estate professionals across the state. Although I'm usually before this committee focusing on home ownership and the residential real estate market, we also have members who focus on the commercial real estate market and represent buyers and sellers of commercial property. My testimony this morning will be brief, but I would like to begin by thanking Representative Sandell for taking the time yesterday afternoon to have a conversation with me about his bill. It was a pleasure meeting him. Mr. Chair, the Minnesota Realtors has serious concerns regarding House File 2756 and the effect increasing capital gains taxes could have on the commercial real estate market in Minnesota, including on investments in the development of multifamily housing. Investors in commercial real estate assess risk and evaluate return when considering projects and properties. And we are concerned that House File 2756 could result in putting Minnesota's commercial real estate market at a competitive disadvantage. Again, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cadoon. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are here to respectfully oppose this bill. This would increase the tax rate on certain income, but that of capital gains to the highest rate in the nation at certain income levels. And we would just be behind at the top rate on this income, just behind California, whose top rate at 13.3% kicks in at $1.1 million. When you're looking at what other states are doing, other states are looking to make their tax code more competitive. Last year, with the federal tax conformity, we saw many states reducing their taxes, and this is obviously going in the opposite direction. For example, the states that reduced their taxes in 2018, Kentucky, Vermont, Idaho, Utah, Georgia, North Carolina, Iowa just enacted substantial reforms that do have triggers, but they would looking to reduce their top rate to 6.8% if they meet those triggers in future years. We've also had other high tax states in recent years looking to reduce their taxes. New York is a great example, Washington, D.C., because they were seeing detrimental impact from their high tax rates. As it was mentioned, taxing capital gains at a higher rate goes against the tax policy of most other states that either treat it exactly like the same as other income, like Minnesota's always done, or tax it at a lower rate. The average and median top capital gains rates in the 40 states that do tax capital gains is about 6%. This would be double that of the other states. This will hit many small business owners that have invested. They've grown their businesses through the years, and then they're looking to sell. This will obviously have a much higher tax rate that now will be impacting those investments by those small business owners. And as mentioned twice in the revenue estimate from the Department of Revenue, this is a very volatile tax. As the Department of Revenue and the revenue analysis mentions, since capital gains can vary widely from year to year, and you see that in the revenue estimates when you're doing the forecasts, how those changes can occur. And as Mr. Fallon mentioned, it's that locked-in effect. The capital gains is really one of those taxes that is at the great discretion of the taxpayer of when capital gains will be triggered or not, because they're in control of when they sell those assets. And because of that, you can have that locked-in effect where they'll just end up holding on to those capital assets for longer than maybe they should have. And when you do that, you really do undermine kind of economic growth, because now you have less capital that is going to be moving in our economy. And as mentioned, a key component for economic growth is capital formation. Capital generally flows to places where it can earn the greatest return. Increasing a tax on a capital gains at a rate that is twice as high as other states will undermine, we believe, investment and capital formation in Minnesota. We respectfully ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to further question for Ms. Cadoon, okay, so before we go to further questions, I'm going to ask, is there anyone else who would like to, in the audience, would like to testify for or against House File 2756 as amended? Very good. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that nobody else is here to testify, so I was just wondering, there's three folks that have concerns with the bill and nobody supports it. Sounds like one of my bills in a way there. But to the author, a couple of things here. First of all, capital gains, when the tax comes in, it's taxed at the ordinary income rates. What we can't ask members' intentions, but what would the purpose be for this bill? What would it do to further goodness and graciousness in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, thanks very much for the question. Those are questions that I asked as well when I began thinking about this bill and talking with members of our House research staff and other representatives. As you may know, I sit on two other committees which deal with two other issues, education and natural resources, and it was initially my intention to promote the idea of transferring taxes and using capital gains to help support education. But as the session went on and I heard testimony in those committees and read testimony and conversations elsewhere, I recognized that this is a propitious year. We're facing challenges and opportunities that in every area of our discretion that are important for us. With all due respect, with those who testified against the bill, there are probably somewhere between 2,000 and maybe 2,200 individuals in Minnesota who would be affected by this tax. And were they to pay this tax, it means that their income on capital gains and earned dividends would be probably more than $1.3 million a year. So we're talking about a relatively few people with relatively high income. And my intention, I guess, is to suggest that we spread out the responsibility to pay somewhat more broadly. By making contributions from this revenue to the general fund, it would provide our committees and our leadership to make decisions that would be most appropriate.
Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit confused here because this money would be for 1 year. You sell a piece of property once, you're once and done. So, but yet, this legislature is proposing an angel investment tax credit that takes money out of education and health care and all those types of things. But yet, so we're going to take it, I'm confused, we're going to give the angel investment tax credit to rich investors, but then this takes money away from somebody that's worked their whole life and has built up an asset and then goes to sell it, and we'll pay the capital gains at whatever rate here. But you mentioned in your testimony to the author of the bill that this would help fund transportation. How does it do that?
Well, I think Representative Sanders.
Chair Mark Horton and Representative Davids, I think that the demands of that face our transportation system are imposing, and I think that as we divide the resources we have and the needs we have, we'll find a way to fix that. We were in session on Thursday night, I guess, late into the evening, and about 8 o'clock I decided I hadn't had lunch yet, so I went back to my office, and as I looked for my lunch, the phone rang. I thought it was my wife, and so I answered it, and it was a constituent from Woodbury who said, I really oppose the efforts that you're talking about, raising taxes, particularly the gas tax, and I have to say that the potholes on Bailey Road are really bad. And I said, well, in order to take care of the potholes on Bailey Road or anywhere else in St. Paul or Minnesota, we're going to have to make some sacrifices and make some contributions. And I would guess that this contribution of about $200,000 the first year, and as I said, suggested less than that later on. This is not, by the way, an easy bill for any of us to vote for. I, as you know, represent Woodbury, and though it's an affluent area, the median income is about $150,000, and there are more than 3,000 people in that district who earn more than $200,000. So I have a number of constituents who are going to be affected by this bill. The bill is not going to be easy for individuals like Representative Fabian, who might take a look at the bill and say, this is a lot of money to go back and talk to my constituents about. The median income in Representative Fabian's district is about $56,000, the mean $66,000, so that suggests that there are a lot of people struggling. There are about 20,000 workers in his district, representing about 10,000 families. But this bill is going to be tougher for me to go back and talk to my constituents about than it is for someone in a greater Minnesota that represents a community that needs help and needs support. And I think that though I certainly didn't run on the prospect of raising taxes, I think I can go back to my constituents and say this is a state issue. This tax is a fair tax, and this is a tax that all of us can use to protect this economy and this business environment that we enjoy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to the author, you mentioned that this would help out transportation. How does it do that?
Representative
Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can't comment any more intelligently on the individual request that the Department of Transportation might make.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this bill does nothing for transportation. And don't worry about the constituents in the districts, because this would have to become law first. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would also go along kind of the same lines, because I think I heard you, Representative Sandell, at the beginning talk about that this is a big ask, that it would plug holes in the ship, and it would further the ambitious goals of this session. Could you kind of expand upon what you see are those ambitious goals that we need to achieve this year?
Mr. Chair, thanks very much for the question. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. You know, I'm kind of a newcomer here. I've been here only a couple of months. But in my experience at in education and in natural resource environment, I've heard a couple of months of testimony of individuals coming and talking about our environment, not just our physical environment, but this economic environment as well, the environment of representing our human capital as well as our natural capital. Issues of equity are enormously important to people taking a look at our future of education, equity in our pre-K through 12 and higher education, equity in the variety of people and the way that we meet our educational challenges, and certainly in the areas of protecting our natural resources. I feel strongly about those two areas, and I think this bill would put a significant amount of money into the general fund, which could be used through negotiations, discussion, and an intelligent appropriation of the revenue.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those answers, because I think what you just stated has been the goals of every session for the last 20 years. And so I thought maybe there was something new there that we're going to be moving towards. Again, I think that the real discrepancy becomes, you know, how you prioritize those and where your funding stream comes. But further on in your opening statement, you talked about where these dollars could be used for, and one of them was transportation, as Representative Davids talked about. So it sounds, because these dollars go into the general fund, it seems to me then that you are promoting the idea that indeed we should be using general fund dollars for transportation.
Representative Sandell.
Chair Marquardt, thank you. And Representative, you know the arguments better than I do, of course. I'm only beginning to appreciate how difficult those negotiations and the allocation of scarce resources is. May I mention another short story about the repetition of these issues. I worked for a long time at the university and was the director of a museum there that at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, and I came across a campaign piece which Hubert Humphrey distributed in 1945, and it was an ingenious piece. It was a plastic record, 78 RPM record, that came in the mail. And in 1945, the mail came twice a day, in the morning and the afternoon. And in 1945, many women were at home rather than working outside the home. So the mail could come in, the woman of the house would open the mail, there'd be this plastic phonograph record that they could put right on their phonograph and hear Hubert Humphrey talking, and guess what they were talking about? Jobs, Social Security, and education. So in 1945, Hubert Humphrey was talking about the same issues that we're talking about now. And working hard to accomplish those goals.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just finish up with just kind of a final comment on my perception of the bill. You know, capital gains are those in which are based upon an asset that an individual has earned over their lifetime for whatever, however they sort of do it. And a lot of decisions that they had made, a lot of sacrifices they had to do it. And what basically how I see this bill is it determines that a good portion of that would be best spent by the state rather than by the individual. And I guess I disagree with that, especially when we're talking about the fact that this year we have $1 billion surplus that we can use towards plugging some of these holes, some of the goals that we want to accomplish, and then to add on to the fact that we're going to take more for the state to spend rather than the individual, who actually could do a much better job in investing in their own communities, et cetera. So I also would probably have a hard time supporting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sandell. It was pretty newsworthy at the end of last year that there was going to be this big aquaculture plant that was coming to Laverne, Minnesota, and I got excited because I was going to be 100 or more new workers, and I was going to sell a lot of refrigerators to them when they came into town. But they announced at the end of the year that they were moving to Madison, South Dakota, and they talked about some of the MPCA policies that went with that. But conveniently, they were also moving to an area that was in an opportunity zone. And so their investors are going to be able to see a bigger reward than what they were going to get in Laverne, where there wasn't an opportunity zone in that area. In response to that, our local community EDA and actually the Rock County, my home county, created its own EDA to help take advantage of and advertise the opportunity zones because of the benefits that are on this particular tax at the federal level. And it, as we have discussed this bill today and the proposal that's in front of us, I really feel that this will be a deterrent for that when we're trying to do the exact opposite at the federal level. And so how do I convince my folks back home that this isn't a deterrent for investment?
Representative Schumacher, are you asking if this tax applies to the opportunity zones? Or just to be clear?
This was just on the capital gains tax in general, Mr. Chair.
Okay, but not just the opportunity zones?
Correct.
Okay. Representative Sandell.
Chair Marker, thank you. Representative Schumacher, I heard about the issue in Laverne early on in conversations in the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I think Representative Fabian probably remembers some of that conversation. There was a lot of discussion about it. I have to say I can't be very detailed in responding to your questions. So I apologize for that. I just can't be very good at it. I do want to mention a couple things about the capital gains tax. Having grown up in a family that was decidedly Republican, I understand the ideas of an individual making decisions rather than government making decisions about one's income. But the capital gains tax is a little unusual in that an individual who begins as an entrepreneur or begins accumulating their own capital or their own assets can see those assets grow over a lifetime or over a career and not be taxed on them until the end, until they eventually liquidate their assets or their heirs do. So the gain in the value of that asset is not taxed until the very end, which provides the owner some opportunity to invest and to leverage that the value of his assets, and the tax that we're offering or the tax that we're that we're considering would not tax the first $500,000 of capital gains. It would not tax the sale of Type 2A agricultural property. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, to pay this tax, one would still be realizing an income on capital gains and earned dividend income of more than $1 million a year. So that's a significant income. I'm not discounting your concerns, however, or the concerns that the individuals who testified here. It is, however, I think clear to say that. Over the last 20 or 30 years, when the tax on capital gains has gone up a bit and then down a bit, capital gains is being taxed at a much lower rate than the income that you or I might pay. And this kind of evens the playing field. Some of the material that I've read in preparation for this bill suggests that a low tax rate on capital gains does not really provide a sustainable economic benefit. There are examples when capital gains tax was low in the 1990s, during the sort of dot-com boom, and in the early 2000s during the housing boom. But both those economic growth dropped and lost their momentum relatively quickly.
Representative Schumacher.
Thanks.
Okay, very good. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sandell, thank you for your interest in the part of the state that I've lived in for a long time. Can you tell me what Class 2 or Type 2 agriculture properties are?
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, thank you. We have a lot in common, Representative Fabian, and I acknowledge and respect your experience here. As I understand it, Type 2 agricultural property is property which is crop-producing property. My in-laws produce corn and soybeans and in western Minnesota, and were they to sell that land, it would be considered Type 2A.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns I have with this, yesterday on the House floor, we heard a rather lengthy conversation about housing and apartments and agreements and rentals and all that sort of stuff. And we heard concerns from the realtors and so forth, the possibility of this decreasing investment in housing. I grew up in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and if I'm an entrepreneur and I decide that I want to go into a housing project to construct and do something to make some money and provide a place for people to live, knowing what the tax rates are in Minnesota and knowing what capital gains rates are in Minnesota versus North Dakota, do you think that as an investor you would build that apartment complex in Moorhead between Concordia College and Minnesota State at Moorhead, or in Fargo closer to NDSU?
Representative Chair and Representative Fabian, that's really an interesting question. It'd be hard to say. As a lifelong Minnesotan, I have certain loyalties here and would probably invest in Minnesota. On the other hand, I understand that there's a demand in the area you're talking about, and that would be a consideration of mine. But I think there are other subjective considerations that would enter into the decision.
Representative Phoebe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your opening comments, you referred to responsible business practices.
Yes.
What is your definition of responsible business practices, and give me some examples, please.
Chair Marquardt.
Representative Sandell.
Chair Marquardt and Representative Fabian, thanks very much for the question, because I put that word in last night, and I thought about using the word. When I campaigned, I talked to people in my district about encouraging responsible business, and I guess when I talked to my neighbors about it, I was talking about businesses that dealt fairly with their employees, were respectful of the environment they chose to build their business, and recognized that they were members of a community which was really larger than themselves and their immediate business practices and decisions. That's a vague answer, I know, but it's based on, a subjective decision in my decision to include the word responsible.
Go ahead, Representative.
I may also say that the 3M is not in my district. It's right across the street from Highway 94, and there are a lot of 3M employees in my district. My dad was a 3M person for a long while, and I think 3M has dedicated itself to a responsible role in our community, a large employer, a worldwide market, interested in the opportunities that it offers its employees and its responsibility to the state.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you got tickets for the golf tournament yet? I'm just kidding. I do have a couple other questions. So then explain to me, and then also in your comments, you said that it was your goal that this increased tax would then encourage responsible business practices. How is taxing someone more, taking more of what they've earned away from them, how does that encourage them to be more responsible in their business practices?
Representative Sandell.
Chair Mark Wharton and Representative Fabian. You're asking let me take that back. My inclination is to offer a kind of a subjective response. Each of us make a philanthropy. Each of us choose areas of philanthropy, and we receive in the mail and sometimes on the phone a variety of requests for help and support. I make some of those, and I'd like to make more, but I have to be kind of focused on those that I support. And I think that a business does the same thing. I think they They say, we've made an investment in Roseau, or we've made an investment in Thief River Falls, or in War Road, or in the southeast metropolitan area. And I want to see that area flourish. And personally, Representative Fabian, I feel very strongly about small town in rural Minnesota. As I said, my in-laws are from there, and I have a strong feeling toward that. So to answer your question, I guess responsible business would be encouraged by a dedication and identity with the community.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Sandell, I appreciate what you're saying and how you're going about doing this. But to me, it's counterintuitive. If you want someone to have more with which to be philanthropic, if you take that away from them, they have less to put back into their hometown, their community, their neighborhood,
you're right,
whatever you want to say. So I think that while I respond, I encourage businesses to do these things, and I've mentioned before that great company in World spending $26 million to build a senior care center. Yeah. The family did that on their own. That's the type of stuff that we do. I would encourage you, if you feel strongly about certain things, I would have encouraged you to dedicate these funds, because I don't see anything in this that's going to fix the potholes on Bailey Road. And if you feel so strongly about rural Minnesota, which I really appreciate because I do too, I would have dedicated the money to cities of less than 10,000 people and counties that have populations of less than 25 people per square mile. Kitson County has 4.1 people per square mile in their population. I appreciate what you're doing here. I look forward to showing you around District 1A when you come up next summer. But I do think that overall this is not a good way to stimulate business in Minnesota and encourage investment to produce student housing and those types of things. So with that, I'll move on, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Loffel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a lot of the discussion has been about active participation, creating a business. But a lot of this is going to be passive income from people who are just strategic or smart or lucky, either in picking the right stock or in being born into the right family and inheriting incredible wealth at a new basis on which no taxes were paid necessarily. And this is to get $500,000 in capital gains income in 1 year, you have to have substantial wealth. And probably most of that is not by the sweat of your brow and buying and running an apartment building. It's by stocks that were maybe inherited, maybe chosen by you. And to me, it's always seemed a little strange that the person who puts 40 hours of their own life into a paycheck gets taxed at a higher rate than someone who just, you know, reading the business pages or going on some other basis, picks a stock and happens to make a wise choice, but that income is actually taxed at a lower basis than the one in which you actually put your time, your effort, your smarts in for 40 hours out of a week. And, so to me, this is about also looking at that passive income, some of which has never been paid any taxes over generations as it's been passed on. And in my community, actually in the block across from me, there was a woman named Emma B. Howe. And she just happened to get lucky in that the secretarial job that she got long ago was for Deluxe Check when it first started up. And they couldn't always make payroll. So they gave her some stock, and she put it in the back of the file cabinet and lived in this modest little two-bedroom house on the block across from me. And when she passed away, her friends and neighbors and relatives were just shocked because the Emma B. Howe Foundation for $23 million was created to do good works. And, if she'd taken a job as a secretary at a real estate office, at the local school district, she wouldn't have had those opportunities and she wouldn't have been able to create that. And it's a wonderful legacy that she's left. But, she could have also left it to friends and relatives, and they would not have earned it at all. They would have just been lucky to have once upon a time known Emma. And this is a mix of those kinds of situations, and it's only 2,700 people, and I would really love it if we could find some information about how many of those 27 of the richest people in Minnesota getting $500,000 in 1 year in capital gains actually earned it by creating a business, by investing their time, sweat, and toil into something versus inheriting it from other relatives or just making a lucky, getting a lucky break, whether it's like Emma finding the right employer and riding the wave, or it's someone who happened to get in the ground floor of a company when it was first forming and buying stock in it. And so I think that we have to realize that there's a real mix here, but I suspect a lot of these 2,700 wealthiest people in Minnesota didn't earn it by starting a company from day one.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, Representative Sandell, for bringing this forward. I think it's a good discussion that we're having. Something that I care a lot about are addressing wealth disparities. And, you know, we know there's an article from the Minneapolis in the Star Tribune. It was some research that was done by the Fed. The wages of working to middle class have not risen after inflation for 40 years, not keeping pace with cost of housing, education, and health care. It's tough to build wealth without owning stocks, a business, or a value-appreciated house. And the reality is that that's most of our constituents. You know, they might have the house and maybe have a little bit of equity there, but, you know, most of the people in our state, you know, if you look at the charts, the number of people who are owning capital gains, it isn't your average Minnesotan isn't making $500,000 a year on investment. And so kind of going off of what Representative Loeffler was just speaking to, I push back on this narrative that somebody has worked their whole life and earned this over their lifetime. You know, they're really capital gains are generated by wealth, not by work. And I mean, I would go even further than saying it's not just luck. It's if you happen to have the, I guess, the privilege of being born into a family that has a lot of wealth, that's most likely going to be passed on to you. And then those disparities are just going to continue to be even worse and worse over time when we have the folks who are wealthy just getting wealthier. If there's only 40 hours a week, you know, there's only so many hours in a week, and the folks that are earning their income by working, there's only so much that they have the opportunity to earn. And so I thank you for bringing this forward. You know, you mentioned something about it might being hard to bring back to your constituents. I would be happy to talk to my constituents about how they're being treated as working people as opposed to the wealthiest folks in our entire state. I forget the number you said, but it was like 2,000 something people out of how many people that live in our state. And so I thank you for bringing this forward. I think this is a really good discussion we're having about wealth and wealth disparities and some of those differences and who benefits and who doesn't. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Very good. Representative Wozinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, it's been brought up a couple times of, you know, paying their fair share and this and that. I can tell you who didn't earn it is anyone in this room from these folks. You know, this is an interesting conversation. And, you know, often the most mobile folks, you know, as Representative Schumacher mentioned, those are the folks that can actually move. And those are the folks that can go to Wisconsin, or the, especially if you're a rural county from a rural district from our neck of the woods. You know, I've had a number of constituents who have moved assets. I mean, our governor, former governor, Governor Dayton, that's where he had his family's trust, was in South Dakota. And the capital gains rate out there is zero. And, you know, the idea is that, well, people are getting lucky, they get a stock. You know, they can pick losers, too. You know, I know a lot of folks, even in an upmarket, can manage to lose money. And, you know, I think, unless you're with Representative David's investments, but You know, I think, you know, as a farmer, I do appreciate the idea that you're going to eliminate the sale of 2A land. Why?
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Representative. I think the thinking there is that the land has an individual purpose, and I hope I'm not off on a wrong track in this reasoning, but it produces an agricultural crop, and farmers are capitalists; they're businessmen and women. And their investment and their risk is clear. But the investment they've made in their land is not as mobile as someone who may be a hedge fund manager, perhaps, or be an executive at a major corporation. And at least that's my thinking. And I'm sure it appears kind of fuzzy, but that's the way I think about it.
Representative Swazinski.
So you, just to kind of, from what I gathered, what you said is, so you eliminate, you're essentially not going to tax it at capital gains rate because it's not mobile?
Let me mention.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Let me take a step back a little bit. Early in January, I approached the House research staff with another idea about financing education. And as I went up and spoke with members of their staff, I said, I'm kind of interested in finding a progressive way of ed finance rather than depending on the relatively regressive taxes of property income and sales. And I said, what about a wealth tax? And the advice I got was really good advice. Wealth is much more mobile than other taxes. It could be moved from one state to another relatively easily. It might be used as a national tax. There are some candidates these days who are talking about a wealth tax. But I agree with you that the idea of wealth can be moved quickly and easily. But capital gains, I think, are a little bit different. I think that I have to say that my answer is somewhat subjective, but it seems to me that an individual chooses to live in a certain area of the country where they can make investments, where their business can prosper, and they kind of stay there. There may be investments, there may be a move under certain circumstances from Minnesota to South Dakota or to North Dakota across the border, but I think there are subjective decisions about that businessmen and women make. So I do believe that this tax, though I know that it's a dynamic circumstance we live in, but the economy is dynamic as well. I think that the capital gains is a reasonable and a wise way to approach a more progressive tax system.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate that answer a little bit. You know, I just look at other businesses that are deeply rooted in the community. You talked about the philanthropic side of things, but you know, the idea that, you know, I had a small family food manufacturing company in my district just sell. And, you know, that was a mom-and-pop shop where the family had been investing in it for years and years and years. Some of the family members were, you know, involved in the operation and some weren't. I'm interested to see why you would separate, you know, a business potentially and potentially assets in town versus a business and assets that would be out like farmland. Why would you draw that line between a business that's, you know, located and invested and taking those profits? I mean, you know, oftentimes you look at capital gains. I do. Is so in good years, you know, you have some extra finances as a family to maybe invest or buy a piece of land or simply put it in the market. To let it do some growing, because I mean, inflation happens, things happen, and then at times those dollars are going to be drawn back out to potentially, you know, even a low period of time. And essentially, what I view this tax is doing is saying, hey, when things are high and government's not doing so well, we're going to just take that but we're going to, you know, take it out of your family. We're going to do whatever. I mean, 70% of families supposedly, I read an article, are, you know, by the second generation, are not wealthy. If they came from a wealthy family, they're not. So it's really about the managing. It's about individuals. It's not. It's less about luck and velocity of money and the rest. But why would you make that difference between a family or business in town versus, you know, some land?
Representative Sandell, be kind of quick, because I think we're on the same line of thinking here for the last couple of questions. So let's make it very short.
Thank you, Chair Mark Reardon, Representative. I think that the conversation we're having this morning is productive and useful. And to all the questions that I've had from this side of the table and the support over here, I'd like to continue the conversation and discussion. I think this bill is a good way to face our future, and would like your support, and I'd also like your conversation later on.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the sake of time, I'm not going to ask a question, but I do have some concerns.
Sure.
You would frame this as a fair tax, and I sort of get it now because it's only 2,700 people, so, you know, not too many of our constituencies are probably in that 2,700. But what I don't understand is now we're moving it to the highest rate in the nation. It's two times as high as some other states. And the net effect of that is now we're encouraging capital get locked up. And the net effect of that, from the realtors, I just said that multifamily housing units may not be built because that capital is locked up. So I really have a hard time understanding how we're calling this fair when now it's going to be, like I said, the highest rate in the nation, twice as high as some other states. And the net effect of that is you're locking up all this capital, because who's going to want to move the capital when you're taxed so high? And according to the realtors, the multifamily housing market, we need housing so badly, and so why would we do anything that would impede that? I don't understand that part, but I get it. You know, it's only 2,700 people, so there's not a whole lot of them in any one of our districts, and so, you know, how loud can they be? But I just have a hard time understanding the true net effect of this and how that's fair. And I don't have a question, just a comment.
Well, Chair Mark Gordon,
Representative Petersburg. We'll let you come back. Yeah. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to caution the committee. We've heard situations or comments about, well, these people didn't earn it, or they didn't earn it, or that this is only based upon their investments. I think we want to be real careful about depicting, you know, what we say, because all of us are given skills and talents, but we also are given the choices of how we use them. And some of us may choose more of a social path, some may check others, but just to say they didn't earn it, that is probably an unfair practice, and we ought not to talk about that way. In regards to another comment, talk about wealth disparity, you know, one of the concerns that I have is I think oftentimes what we're trying to do is control everybody's wealth, and that only works if we hold everybody captive. In other words, we can't make them pass on the cost of this, or we can't keep them from moving out of state. But the reality is everybody can. And so when you do that with the option and understanding that they'll be able to pass on, especially on income taxes, capital gains is not as much, but when they can pass it on to the consumer pays it, which then becomes even more regressive. So I just think it's not as simple as saying, well, there's wealth disparity, and by dealing with the upper levels, that all of a sudden there's going to be this boon to the lower level incomes. I think it's more complex than that, and so I think we need to be real careful about generalizing at that level. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. We've got two more on the list. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you very much. This is actually quite a disturbing conversation as I think about it, because, you know, I started with nothing and have done very, very well, and I didn't inherit the money. It wasn't passive. I'm very charitable. I worked hard for the money that I have, spent a lot of time away from my family and my kids to do it. But yet, and as far as an investment community, I never thought I'd own a supper club, but sometimes that's how it goes. But I strongly believe in the equality of opportunity, not the equality of results. This side wants equality of opportunity. The other side wants equality of results. That's not how this should work. And when it comes to making widgets, or somebody has a good idea, you invent a better mousetrap and you make a bazillion dollars, who cares? As long as it's done legally. Why do we have this fixation on how much money people have? Why do we have this fixation on you've done well, so you have to give it back to us? Tax policy affects behavior. The more you tax with something, the less you will have of it. This is a success tax. The more you tax success, the less you will have of it. And so, members, it'll be interesting to see how my friends on the other side, yeah, this is very progressive. Yes, it is. It's right in my pocket. But it's going to be very interesting to see how the votes come down if you look at the suits index on the sick tax, the gas tax, and the business taxes. It's going to be very interesting to see if there's any consistency in thought here. Because, yes, this is very progressive. No question about it. So it'll be interesting to see how we do on those. But I don't understand this fixation of trying to take money from other people that has been earned legally. And like I said, my wealth, none of it was inherited. None of it. None of it was passive. It was called working every night, working every day. Yeah, I have cut back, Mr. Chairman, to half days. I'm only working 12 hours a day now, just so you know that. But this fixation on taking other people's money just amazes me.
Representative Lesch, and then closing comments by Representative Sandell. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sandell, for bringing this bill. And thank you for recognizing that giant elephant in the room, that these preferential tax treatments for folks who have a lot of money already ain't trickling down. It's not happening. The economy has grown incredibly since I was born in the 70s, but wages for average folks, average Minnesotans, has stayed flat. Okay, one prominent rich guy, who's the Berkshire Hathaway guy again? Buffett. Buffett tells a story about how he's taxed at 20% and his secretary is taxed at 30%, right? So if you have capital gains income, 69% of which goes to the richest 1% of taxpayers in this nation, you're getting preferential treatment. You're getting a better tax rate than everyone else, roughly half already. You're paying half. And I think the idea was that, well, the promise was that this trickles down. This trickles down to everyone, and everyone does better. But we've seen for 40 years that that's a lie. That has not happened. The average person does not get a better job. And the reason for that is obvious. Everyone should see this, right? You know the tax rate on creating a job? It's zero. If you create a job with that money, like you say you're going to do when you trickle it down, you pay zero on that. But you don't want to do that. You know the tax rate on creating the Emma B. Howe Foundation? It's zero. If you're actually doing things that you promised you're going to do for that tons of money that you're getting as a rich person, you don't pay any taxes on it. But you don't want to do that. You want to give it to Swiss bankers or hunt elephants in Africa or ski vacations in Europe or buy fancy foreign cars or something. And you know what? That's fine. There's no problem with that, okay? But you should have at least pay a fair tax rate on it. But you don't even want to do that. So I'm perplexed that this promise that has been perpetuated by folks that no, you're gonna threaten people who are making a lot of money. They said that this was for the good of all of us. And they still promise that this is going to be for the good of all of us if we give rich people preferential treatment. But we don't need to rely on promises because we have history as evidence. It's, you know, what year was it? When Reagan kept capital gains rates commensurate with other income taxes, it used to be at 50% until 1986. Mm-hmm. You were paying 50% on that. So after 1986, it goes far, far down. We're at, what, 15% now federally? Okay. And the promise is that, oh, yeah, no, we're reinvesting, we're creating jobs. No, you're not.
Because we would see it. We would see wages go up, and they haven't gone up. We would see manufacturing jobs in America increase, but we don't. We see it offshore, and that's because people want to keep their money. They don't want to do the good things with it. History shows us, Representative Sandel, that we need a bill like yours, because this widening wealth gap is only helping the richest 1%. So I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion. I, too, am a little bit flummoxed about the chicken little sky is falling worries that's going to happen if we tack on 3% to people making over $500,000. And I can't understand where that's coming from, because anyone who has any basic concept of history that's happened in the last 4 years knowing that that's the exact opposite of what has happened since we've given rich people preferential tax rates. So thank you for the bill, and I'll look forward to seeing this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do have to correct the record. My good friend Chair Lesh said that employers do not pay taxes on employees. Last I looked, they're still paying FICA taxes and UI taxes and probably soon family paid leave taxes. So they do pay taxes.
Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. It's been my intention to encourage our legislature and our constituents as we look for the future and the opportunities that it offers. It's never been my intention to disparage hard work or wise investment. It's instead an effort to level the playing field a bit and to enhance the state in which we live. I think House File 2756 will do that. I appreciate the support that members have offered to the bill, and I look forward to further conversations with members who have questions. Thank you, thank you, Chair Marquardt.
Very good. Thank you very much. Representative Leslie Gard renews his motion to lay over House File 2756 as amended for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Sandel. Members, we've got two more bills, and this discussion was very good. If we don't get through these bills, we do have room 500 South reserved for 4:30 this afternoon. So just like I said, the discussion is good, but we will recess if we don't get through all the bills today. So Representative Gomez, you are next.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Just so you know, the 4:30 works for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going home this evening.
Very good. And there's no hockey games that I know of tonight either. So I think the final Frozen Four starts on Thursday.
Duluth made it.
Very good. All right. Representative Gomez, would you move your bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2753 to be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Very good. So please proceed.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So 2753 expands the first bracket of Minnesota's individual income tax by increasing the income level at which the second tier rate of 7.05% begins. It also expands the fourth bracket by lowering the income level at which the fourth tier rate of 9.85% begins. So did you guys get the modeling memo from House Research? I think it's maybe being passed out now.
Representative, we do have a revenue estimate here. And is there modeling also in the, we can get that out to members later. We don't have the modeling, but we do have the revenue estimate.
Representative Gomez. Apologies. When you receive the memo from House Research, you'll see that basically this decreases taxes on 1.295 million returns, and those decreases are clustered at income levels below $150,000 a year, and it increases taxes on 114,000 returns, and those increases again are clustered at above 150,000. So this bill introduces a little bit more progressivity, a little bit more fairness in the breakdown of who pays taxes in income taxes in Minnesota and the amounts they pay. And I'm happy. I know there are a few people here to testify against my bill. But
why don't we take the testifiers if we could? So we've got Mr. Phelan. And then Ms. Larson and Ms. Cadoon. Mr. Phelan, welcome again.
Hello.
Please state your name.
My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist with the Center for the American Experiment, a think tank based in Golden Valley. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill. Minnesotans are some of the most heavily taxed citizens in America. In our report, the State of Minnesota's Economy 2018, we at the Center noted that Minnesota's top rate of income tax is the fourth highest in the country. But it's not just the rich who are taxed heavily. The state's bottom rate of income taxation is higher than the top rate in 23 states. This explains, we believe, in some degree why, from 2011 to 2016, the most recent year for which we have data, IRS figures show Minnesota losing residents on net in every income category above a modest $25,000 annually. It is not just the rich who are leaving, even Minnesota's middle class appears to be looking elsewhere too. Before taking any more of Minnesotans' hard-earned money from them, legislators ought to be asking whether Minnesotans are getting what they are currently taxed for. Recently, Senator Franson said, "When people and businesses come here, they're not doing us a favor to pay their taxes. They know what they're getting in return with the investments that we make in our roads and bridges and education and workforce." Obviously, this is hard to reconcile with the views of the governor, who said recently that Minnesota's crumbling infrastructure is putting our safety at risk and says that we need to hike taxes to remedy this. Indeed, civil engineers recently reported that parts of Minnesota's transportation system are in poor condition, and any gas tax hike could only be used to fix roads and bridges, which the report graded C and D plus. So even with its citizens' current heavy tax burden, the state government is failing to fulfill a core function. Looking at the numbers, it is hard to believe the state's government is so hard up it cannot fulfill a core function like maintaining roads without a fresh, deep dip into taxpayers' pockets. Data from the Department of Revenue shows that state tax revenues have risen by 31% in real terms since 2010 and in real per capita terms by 25% over the same period. This is complicated a little by federal taxes and spending, but according to Census Bureau data, Minnesota's state government total revenue in 2017 was higher than any year previously. Our state government's total expenditure in 2017 was higher than in all but one previous year. With the money lawmakers already take from Minnesota citizens and the $1 billion surplus they are projected to have over the next 2 years, there's no excuse for soaking the state citizens afresh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Larson. Good morning. Please
Good morning.
State your name.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I'm Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Just a couple of comments on this bill. We do have concerns about this bill in terms of increasing the taxes on the top bracket. As has been mentioned, our top marginal income tax rate at 9.85% is already the fifth highest in the country. But when you look at the level of income at which the tax rate kicks in, it's actually the second highest in the country. Only Oregon's 9.9% rate kicks in at the lower level of income. Minnesota's, theirs starts at 125. If you compare this proposal to the other states that have higher marginal tax rates, for a single filer at the $150,000 level income level, this would be Minnesota would be at a 9.85% rate at that income level. California's rate would only be 9.3%. Hawaii's would be 9.0%. New York's 6.49%. New Jersey's rate 6.37%. And their next marginal rates don't kick in until a much higher income level. So our individual income tax rates are already uncompetitive, and this will only worsen that. It can be an impediment to recruiting talent to Minnesota. We do hear that from our the leaders in our companies. And the proposal increases taxes on Minnesotans that are already paying the second highest rate, and those are the same taxpayers that are being nicked by the loss of the state and local tax deduction at the federal level. Now, I know that's not a Minnesota issue, but it will impact Minnesota because essentially what happened by losing that SALT deduction or capping the deduction, it raised the tax prices of Minnesota state income taxes by about 40%. So it effectively is moving our 9.85% rate to about a rate of 16.3%. And I think Ms. Cadoon will mention this. This will also impact businesses that are passed through companies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cadoon? Good morning again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are want to testify first in actually support of parts of Representative Gomez's bill to actually lower tax rates, but we believe that should be extended to all taxpayers. So we are opposed to the provisions that are then raising tax rates, and we believe especially we should be extending that tax relief to all taxpayers, especially those tax rates where we're the most uncompetitive, which really is at the upper income tax rates. In today's world of global competition, increased mobility, and as Ms. Larson talked about with the new SALT cap cap on the deductibility of state and local taxes, our state tax rates and burdens will matter even more. Over 90% of our businesses are pass-through entities, which means they pay their taxes through the individual income tax. They employ over 56% or more of the private sector is employed in those businesses. High tax rates do mean less money available for investment in their business, in their employees, in their equipment. Pass-through income is taxed even when it's not distributed to the owners and shareholders. That's called that phantom income. And it's recognized for income tax purposes even if the income is retained in the business. Studies have found that high tax rates do negatively impact entrepreneurship, investment, talent recruitment and retention, the very items needed for a growing economy. It's been mentioned about the progressivity of our tax system. If the goal is to have the most progressive system in the nation, then that goal has been met. I have a handout from the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence that was handed out to you earlier. If you look at that bottom chart, it does show that Minnesota has the most progressive tax system currently in the nation with our current tax rates. This chart, when you look at the top part of the chart as well, shows you how with our progressive income tax system, what the incomes are at in the tax rates, how we compare with other states. So if you're looking at, for example, joint filers, we rank at the income of $35,000 at 42nd in the nation. That's basically at the bottom because there are other states that are, do not tax them at all. But then that increasingly those rankings go up as you go up the income scale. So at incomes of $500,000, we rank second highest in the nation currently. At incomes of $1 million, we rank fourth highest in the nation. So I believe if you're looking at progressivity, that goal has been met. The other thing I would point out is Minnesota relies greatly on our wealthier households and business owners to fund state spending. It is important, if you're looking for state spending, then, that we do not create disincentives for those high earners to remain in Minnesota, to relocate to Minnesota, or to invest in Minnesota. We urge you, as you're looking at federal tax conformity, we do believe this still provides a tremendous opportunity to enact some pro-growth tax reforms and focus on reducing income tax on all four brackets. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just to be clear, this does not raise tax rates. It's working on the brackets. I think that was mentioned a few times.
Brackets, the final four.
The brackets, and not the final four.
Ms.
Cadoon.
Just to clarify, but when you're freezing, you're lowering that where that top rate kicks in at $250,000, so effectively you're increasing taxes, which is what the revenue estimate does show. But I agree, it's not increasing the rates. That was the previous bill.
Thank you very much. Before I go further, anyone from the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 2753? Seeing none, Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions for Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams, what would the tax cut be for someone filing married jointly with a FTI of $35,000?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, it would depend somewhat on that person's Minnesota subtractions. If their FTI was $35,000, assuming they had no Minnesota additions or subtractions, then the bill would not affect their tax.
So, Chairman, Mr. Williams, they would not get any cut at all at the lower bracket. What would be the tax cut for someone filing married jointly with a FTI between $150,000 and $200,000?
Mr. Williams. Between $115,000 and $200,000? 150 and 200,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, again, it would depend if they have Minnesota additions or subtractions. Assuming they had no Minnesota additions or subtractions, they would get the full, assuming they were married filing jointly, they would pay the lower 5% rate on sort of the change in brackets. So it's about a, it's like a $1,700 or so in change in the amount of income that's subject to the lower rate rather than the higher rate. So I did the math, and it's about, I think, $29 is the change in tax for anyone that sort of lands, that benefits from the change in the first year rate.
Well, thank you, Mr. Williams. So somebody at 35, which it would be lower with, I mean, married, so it's jointly, gets nothing. The rich get $29. Well, what's the average tax cut for people across the board? Mr. Williams.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, when I modeled this proposal, the average change was 25, or the average decrease amongst those getting a decrease was $25.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams. So this helps the rich and does nothing for joint filers at $35,000. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Williams. Are you asking Mr. Williams?
Yeah.
Mr. Williams?
I'll just leave it at that. There, we got time here. Not time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm kind of curious. It seems like the current leadership loves inflators. They love to keep inflating things with inflation. And there's some, you know, justification maybe for that, and certainly some desire for that. But it surprises me that based upon the information that has been presented here, these new tax brackets were increased about 4.5% over what the inflated base is, but the top level was actually reduced by almost 9% from what the adjusted base would have been, and goes back to the 2013 base, which means that people who are making $260,000 last year, this year they're making the same exact amount, they're going to have a 2% increase in their rates, which seems to me that it does indicate that. So my curiosity is why didn't you keep the inflated value from the 2013 bill when you chose this, and at least freeze it at that level rather than regressing back?
Representative Gomez.
I guess I would ask for an assist from House Research, because I don't wasn't here in 2013, and I'm not exactly clear on the trend in terms of inflation and the different rates. So, I would ask for them to chime in on this one.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez in Petersburg. When the fourth tier was enacted in 2013, for married couples filing jointly, the fourth tier started at $250,000. Since then, sort of those brackets have been adjusted for inflation annually. So if you look at the bill summary, the base for tax year 2019 is that the fourth tier would start at $273,150. So the bill does sort of return back to the amount that was sort of originally enacted when the fourth tier was enacted in 2013.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. That was exactly my understanding, and primarily because of Section 2, when it uses the base for starting it later back to 2020 or 2018, whatever the months are, rather than going back to 2013. So that means that the top bracket then regresses back to that level, because it's kept at a flat rate here and a change, and which just surprises me that we don't allow that to grow the same as we did all the other brackets. So it actually is shrinking some of the top tier brackets with the lower tier brackets. So pretty soon everybody will be at the top bracket. So just curiosity is why you didn't just allow that to inflator to stay there instead of regressing back.
So Representative Gomez, I think you have a bill that is basically revenue neutral.
Right. Yeah.
And so you're raising the bracket for the lower tier and lowering it for the top tier. Why? I think that's kind
right.
of the question
idea,
that's
the idea
being
was
asked.
Just, was to adjust within, you know, kind of the same pot of revenue to adjust those rates so that, and I will just draw people's attention back to the fact that this provides a tax decrease to 1.3 million taxpayers in our state. So that was the idea with this effort.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Well, in order for me neutral, that means that somebody else is paying the additional. So there is an increase there, so in taxes. Thank you.
Any other comments? Not Representative Gomez, any closing comments?
I just am thankful for consideration of 2753 for the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Gomez renews her motion to lay over House File 2753 for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Gomez. Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler, would you like to move your bill, House File 2706?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would love to move 2706 for committee consideration.
Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this kind of changes us to a little different topic from what we've been talking about this morning, which can often involve individuals owning stock in other companies. This is about companies owning stock in or having an ownership interest in other companies. And right now, corporate taxpayers can claim a deductions for dividends received from another corporation. So if they own part of another business and get dividends from that business, they get a deduction. And right now, the amount varies. If the recipient owns 20% or more of the stock of the paying corporation, then they pay 80%, then the dividend reduction is 80% of the dividends received. But if they own less than 20% of the stock of the paying corporation, then the dividend received deduction is 70% of the dividends received. And dividends are only deductible to the extent that they're in Minnesota, apportioned in Minnesota, and they have income in Minnesota. This proposed bill would adjust both of those percentages by 2%, a pretty modest adjustment. Just like some of the previous bills, it has an impact on a small number of all the hundreds of thousands of businesses in Minnesota. There are only about 6,700 taxpayers who would be impacted by this. And once again, it's just the situation where a corporation owns a part of another corporation.
Very good. I'm going to go to testifiers, if that's all right with members. So we have Ms. Cadoon and Ms. Larson. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For my third time up this morning, Beth Cadoon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. So I'll keep this short because I know you don't want to come back. This is really a longstanding tax policy in Minnesota regarding the dividends received deduction. It's been in law since 1947 and also obviously a longstanding policy in the U.S. tax code as well. The main disadvantage for C corporations is double taxation. Which is a corporation pays taxes on its income, and then shareholders pay taxes when they receive that dividend. What the dividend received deductions intended to do is avoid triple taxation. So triple taxation occurs when that same income is taxed in the hands of the company paying the dividend, then in the company that's receiving the dividend, and again when the ultimate shareholder is receiving the dividend. So what the current 80% DRD does is it lessens that triple taxation. So that's really the goal of it, and we oppose this law change. We already have some of the highest corporate tax rates in the nation. As you know, the corporate tax is a regressive tax as well, and we believe if you're looking to broaden the corporate tax base, then we should be looking to lower that high tax rate that we do believe has a detrimental impact on our economy. I know Ms. Larson is going to talk about how we compare with some of the other DRDs, so I'll end at this that
good.
Point.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Ms. Larson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jill Larson, Minnesota Business Partnership. Echo Ms. Cadoon's comments. The only thing I would add is that my understanding is most states give 100% DRD. And for the other states that aren't at 100%, most are at 80 or above. There are a few that are at 95. A lot of them are at 85 and the others that are at 80. So this, again, would make Minnesota an outlier, and for that reason, we think it sets a bad precedent. So for that reason, we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, questions or comments on House File 2706? Representative Woffler, closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think this is just another way of rebalancing our tax code, and in as we consider that the corporations who are subject to this are the ones that most benefited from the federal tax reforms of 2017, and it's our largest, wealthiest corporations in general.
Thank you very much. And you renew, Representative Woffler renews her motion to lay over House File 2706 for possible inclusion of the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Members, a quick announcement on the omnibus tax bill. So the intention is to have this up on the tax committee website on Sunday night, and also will be emailed out to all members. And on the everyone on the serve list will get out there. Then on Tuesday, the intent would be a walkthrough with public testimony with markup on the bill on Wednesday. So that's kind of the agenda for right now. So members, Representative Swazinski? Oh, no, we have more work to do, Representative Swazinski. We're going to continue on until the very end. And so Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Will we be hearing the property tax division bill before that?
Representative Petersburg, no, that'll just become part of the tax bill, and then when we go over the walkthrough of the tax bill, we'll be going over that at the same time. So, members, thanks so much for your work and discussion today. And we are, Chair Davids.
When do we see the transportation gas tax increase and the sick tax? Sick tax.
Okay. I am not aware of those bills necessarily, Representative Davids, but we are hearing the transportation bill and the HHS bill at the end of next week, I believe, we'll be hearing those bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Members, we are adjourned.